Right, well, let's have a look at something else that helps us determine whether someone's employed or self-employed. This thorny issue of employment protection and benefits. Because one of the most significant differences between a direct employee and a self-employed worker is likely to be the entitlement to employment protection and indeed the enjoyment of employee benefits. Employees have the protection of employment law and the benefits that employment rights bring with the job. They have the right to a notice period and can take action for unfair dismissal and constructive dismissal if the terms of their employment are changed without their agreement. A contract for services, as opposed to an employment contract of service, is usually only terminated on completion of a job or if one or both of the parties are in breach of the contract. Effectively, the contract can be terminated without notice on either side. Where it is agreed, preferably in writing, that set rights and benefits are not within the terms of the engagement, this will create an indicator of self-employment. It's important to be able to differentiate between the terms and conditions enjoyed by direct employees as opposed to those offered to the self-employed, who are suppliers of services and should meet, for example, their own out-of-pocket expenses. I think this is quite an important thing. Some of the items may seem somewhat petty, but if the revenue go into a company and they're looking at a consultant, freelancer, what have you, and they compare them with employees who they may be working alongside if it's a short-term project, if they find that they have the same rights and benefits, what have you, they're going to argue that they're employees. But if they find that they're paid in a different way, they don't enjoy the benefits, even the method of reimbursing their travel should be different for the self-employed person as opposed to the employed person. Always look at that. Look for the differentiation, which is important. Now, another very important point, and something that's come out of the decisions in the courts, is the intentions of the parties, a point that was mentioned in the revenues manual. Employment status is clearly often a big grey area, with different factors pointing in different directions, some pointing towards employment, some pointing towards self-employment. And the result is that there will often be many ambiguous cases where one person might decide employment, and another person on the same facts might decide self-employment. And at the end of the day, we might want to look to the intentions of the parties. Case law supports that view, and the eminent Lord Denin said so in the Court of Appeal in 1997 in Massey versus Crown Life Assurance. He said, "It seems to me on the authorities that when it is a situation which is in doubt, it is open to the parties by agreement to stipulate what the legal situation between them shall be. If their relationship is ambiguous and is capable of being one or the other, then the parties can remove the ambiguity by the very agreement itself, which they make with one another." What does all that mean? It means if you weigh up all the balancing factors, and you could almost toss a coin to make the decision, if it's fairly even, if the written stated intentions of the parties are that it's self-employment, then the courts would accept that. Okay, let's look at a couple of other issues to do with employment status that often causes AAT members to be concerned. First of all, payments to a limited company, commonly known as IR35. A valid contract between two companies is not a contract of employment, but an employment status challenge might arise if the engager appears to be engaged in John Smith instead of John Smith Limited. A key point there is, again, the IR35 protection of a consultant, freelancer, etc., switching the onus to the intermediary, that's the rules of IR35 brought in 2000, it only applies if the contract is with the intermediary, with the limited company, as opposed to the individual. I also want to check, is the contract with the individual or with the intermediary, and who are the payments made to? Again, for IR35 to provide protection to the engager, the contract should be with the limited company, the payments should be made to the limited company, not to the individual. Okay, something that's a pretty hot topic at the moment is managed service companies. And from 6th of April 2007, all payments received by individuals providing their services through managed service companies have been subject to pay as you earn. And from the same date, the cost of travel from the individual's home to the individual's place of work is not an allowable tax-free expense for workers within the managed service companies. From the 6th of August 2007, national insurance contributions are also due on all payments received by individuals working through managed service companies. And again from August, where the pay as you earn and national insurance debts of a managed service company cannot be recovered from that company, the revenue may transfer the debt personally to the company's director or to the managed service company provider. Debts may be transferred to other third parties from January 2008. That's a little bit there about managed service companies, but basically you might need to take some advice on that if you've got a client using a managed service company.